Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 15th of September. Just a couple of cool froods that always know where the towels are. What the hell does this mean? What does that mean? What's a frood?
It's a reference to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, of which more anon.
I've just exposed my lack of knowledge of Douglas Adams' masterpiece.
It's a dog whistle to Hitchhikers fans.
All right. So anyway, what did we talk about in this
Well, we talked about Joe Biden, health thereof, and I think more importantly, the impeachment inquiry against him.
Yeah.
And then we moved on to Elon Musk, the new biography by Walter Isaacson, and specifically Elon's love of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
We did. And we also touched on a marvellous exhibition you've been to see at the V&A.
Yeah, the Chanel. Excellent stuff.
And devil dogs.
Yes, and what to do about them.
Yes, indeed. Well, we came to a fairly stark conclusion about that. But
you'll have to listen to find
out. So what are we going to call this episode?
Joe and Elon.
Sleepy Joe and Doolally Don. Or Sleepy Joe or Doolally Don.
Sleepy Joe or Doolally Don.
Is that okay?
I think that's excellent.
You normally name these shows, so I'm going to...
Go for it.
I'm going to go for
it. I like that.
Okay, so this is The Two Matts, episode 13, Sleepy Joe or Doolally Don. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I think we have to talk a bit about Joe Biden because a lot of the news has focused on him this week in various ways. And I guess the first thing that arose was when he was doing a trip around the world, including the G20, he went to Vietnam. And in Hanoi on Sunday evening, he gave a press conference, which I'm afraid to say, because I'm nothing against the guy,
Let me pause you for a moment. When you say you've nothing against him, I have read your Evening Standard column.
Yeah, no, well, I mean...
You make this litany of things you've got against him quite clear.
Well, more in sorrow than in anger, because I think he is now reaching a point of where it's clear that his decline is not just that of age, but you know, it's cognitive, it's psychological.
Well, let's spell it out in plain terms. Is he going senile?
I think he is. And I think it's not just age, because we know that dementia can hit people from their 30s onwards, mostly, you know, 50s, 60s onwards.
Yeah.
So he's 80. But, you know, Michael Heseltine's 90 and he's perfectly lucid.
As is my dad is as sharp as a tack.
Exactly. Yeah, so 90, I actually think that although the age thing has become massively politicised, That's not the key question. So I don't know if our producer Matt Hill has got a clip of
the evidence
of the latest evidence. But, unfortunately,
I met with his number two person here in India today. I just think that there are other things on leaders' minds, and they respond to what's needed at the time. And look. Nobody likes having, but I tell you what, I don't know about you, but I'm going to go to bed.
It's painful.
And it is painful, horribly, you know, the performance was cut off by his his aides, you know, which is a great indignity for a person who's given great public service. He's been vice president. He beat Trump, which is a service we should never, ever, ever forget. He beat Trump in 2020. However, there is a legitimate question now, I think, about his cognitive psychological ability. Is he going senile? The other day in Connecticut, this was in June, he ended a speech with "God Save the Queen."
Man. That's right. It was a bit mad, yeah.
On the day of the Nashville school shooting, he came down and started rambling about ice cream.
Chocolate chip ice cream.
It's strange. You know, he's talked about Putin twice being at war with Iraq. Clearly, his cognitive function is declining fast. Now, what does that mean? It means the Democrats are panicking. Biden is not disposed to step down. He's made it very clear he wants to beat Trump.
Yeah.
If he thinks Trump is going to be the candidate, he will stay in place. So that in order to get rid of him, Vice President Kamala Harris and half of the cabinet would have to use the 25th Amendment of the US Constitution to unseat him, which is a, you know, in the year leading up to an election is disastrous.
The 25th Amendment was conceived after Kennedy was assassinated, right? Because there was a clear concern about what you do about the transfer of power in an emergency. And it covers, you know, the death of a president.
Yeah,
and
most
the incapacitation.
Of it's just common sense.
But this section, and the great irony is, or the great coincidence, is that the 25th Amendment was also being talked about in deposing Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah.
Four years ago. You know,
I mean, where
for being, you know, out of control and
deranged. I mean
yeah.
the in the piece you talked about, I said, you know, there's a kind of the real horror in this is you've got a choice between deranged criminality and advancing senility. Right?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, given, you know, forced choice, obviously I want Biden to win.
Yeah.
But there is a you know, to be unsentimental and sort of clear-eyed about it, there is a problem about having the leader of the free world in this cognitive condition. We know Reagan in the second term was already beginning to exhibit the signs of
dementia. Yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah.
And he was younger.
He was 77
than
when
both
he finished.
Both of them.
That's right.
Both Trump and Biden.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are issues around it. I think Biden will be the candidate, and I think Trump will be the candidate. And I think Democratic strategists are just, they look at the alternatives, Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the sort of maverick anti-vaxxer. None of these people have a chance against Trump. So it does boil down to a kind of global fingers crossed.
The other side to the coin is that if you are a Republican who is, you know, a diehard Republican, but fearful of what Trump means for the Republican Party. But your alternative is a guy that looks like he's, you know, the Sleepy Joe prophecy is coming to fruition. It's going to harden you towards Trump, isn't it? It's going to make you think, well, I might as well give Trump a go.
It will. And also the Biden strategy at the moment depends on the fairly large number of undeclared independents and the soft vote among ethnic minorities for Biden hardening up by Election Day in November 2024. And obviously anything that makes that turnout smaller raises Trump's chances, you know, the nightmare scenario of Trump being re-elected. So, you know, these are things to bear in mind. Then I think we move to an issue on which it's clearer, certainly to me, which is Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, Congressman from California, on Tuesday evening announces an impeachment inquiry into Joe Biden. Now, just to be absolutely clear, an impeachment inquiry is not the same as an impeachment. It's an inquiry which is led by, you know, the Congressional Committee forces. It's going to be overseen by James Comer. And it's to establish the case for an impeachment vote in Congress. Now, I'd be amazed if the inquiry didn't find something.
But I might just pause there for a second, because is it not the first time? I mean, there haven't been that many impeachment inquiries, but the first time where there doesn't, it's like a fishing expedition, this, isn't it? There doesn't even seem to be
That's the
kernel
problem.
Of a
There
of
is
a ground.
No smoking gun. I mean, there has been a lot of investigation of the Biden family. This is I mean, at the heart of it is Biden's son, Hunter.
Yeah.
Who's often sort of treated in discussions as if he's about 20. He's actually 53.
Yeah.
And he has had problems with drugs, and he has had problems with taxes, and with a firearm, but nothing major. And he's not Biden. He's not his father. The broad allegation is that Hunter used his father's name to drum up business in his various dealings with foreign businesses. Well, duh, of course he did.
Yeah.
But that doesn't amount to the high crimes and misdemeanors that you need the test to treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors.
And it's certainly not Joe Biden's fault,
no,
necessarily.
No, there is. I mean, the key is that there is not a scintilla of evidence of Joe Biden having received any financial gain from his son's business dealings.
So the sins of the son shouldn't necessarily be
visited
now, upon the
why,
father.
So you have to ask, why are they doing this? Well, the first is that the Republicans, and especially the sort of wingnut crazy Republicans, want anything that suggests that Biden is not the legitimate president. And the I word, the impeachment word, it keeps the base happy in that respect. The second thing, which is a bit inside baseball, but is very important, is that McCarthy has real problems himself, Speaker of the House. He is facing being deposed himself.
He scraped in to start with.
He's barely scraped in. Yeah. And he's there's all sorts of rows about his negotiations with the Democratic Biden-led government over budgets, and the right want to, you know, tear him to pieces. And this was McCarthy's desperate sort of offering, olive branch, saying, look, I'm going to get Biden impeached. Mm. And Matt Gaetz from Florida, is a congressman from Florida who's leading the opposition to McCarthy, immediately gave a speech saying that it's not enough, you're still on, you know, probation. So McCarthy's doing this from a position of internal weakness. So that's worth bringing up. But I think the most egregious aspect of it all, and the one that one hopes doesn't gain any traction, is they're trying to establish a kind of phony moral equivalence between, you know, some possibly sketchy business dealings by Hunter Biden that almost certainly didn't involve his father at all. Mm. And the fact that Trump is facing 91 charges.
For insurrection.
For insurrection. I mean, just
treason. Yeah.
And it's a classic distraction move. So I just went, you know, I checked out last night. Just this week, right, kind of Trump trial news, right? Okay, in the federal, this is just a few for instances. I could go on forever. In the federal case brought by special counsel Jack Smith against Trump, Trump is demanding the recusal of the judge, Tanya Chutkan, right? Mm-hmm. Two, he's seeking a move of the Georgia case, which is the big one, to federal courts. I doubt it'll succeed, but of course he wants it in federal court so he can pardon himself.
Exactly.
Three, there's a possibility of moving the date of the Manhattan trial, the hush money trial, because of the various, you know, he's in so many trials that actually it's turning into a diary nightmare. Four, there's a case brought by Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics on the basis that using the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, that insurrection is a disqualification for office. And we're going to hear a lot more about that argument.
Okay.
Five, and I promise you this is the last, the journalist E. Jean Carroll's, who you may remember in May, won a civil case showing that Trump was liable for sexual assault against her. She's got a defamation lawsuit against Trump,
right.
And Trump is seeking a delay in that. So the reason I go through that rather sort of prosaic list is just to say that's just this week.
Yeah, the guy's not going to have time to
that's
run the country.
That's a week in the life of Trump.
Yeah.
So when you compare that to what is being alleged against Biden, which is still very vague, there is no smoking gun.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, I think the FT reported that Newt Gingrich, who of course was heavily involved with the impeachment of Clinton, said this could backfire. You know, Newt Gingrich is not a liberal. You know, he's not on the moderate wing of the Republican Party, although, you know, what's a moderate in the world of MAGA, it's very hard to know. But, you know, when Newt Gingrich says, be careful, you should be. So one hopes that this all backfires. The sort of worst case scenario is that it does form a vague sort of moral equivalence in people's minds that both candidates, they're both crooked, which is very much Trump's hope and objective. Yeah. And he's been in contact with with his allies in Congress to behind all this.
And Trump would say, who do you want? Do you want Sleepy Joe the crook or do you want Clever Don the crook?
That's the problem, is that, and this goes back to the you know, let's say at very minimum, the kind of general, the mien and manner of the two candidates is that Trump is deranged, but he's full of vigour and energy.
Yeah.
And Biden is a fading force. And it's so performative.
You wonder whether it will come down to a matter of self-confidence in
the end. That's the problem, is that whereas in 2020, I felt Biden, you know, his kind of he's not blue collar by origin, but he has a sort of commonality with blue collar America. You know, come on, man. In the debates in 2020, he rose up and he wouldn't put up with Trump's nonsense.
Yeah.
Can one be sure he'll do the same in 2024? Less confident. One hopes so. You know, the hope is that Trump enrages him and brings up that sort of deep campaigning spirit.
Yeah.
But it's less of a certainty.
So let's just cast forward a little bit. Let's cross our fingers and say Biden defeats Trump in 24. Then you do, and let's say your thesis is right, that his mental faculties are declining, and that's going to be progressive and it will get worse. And, you'll find yourself in a situation in 25, 26, where you have the leader of the free world, the leader of the most powerful nation on the planet, who is ostensibly Gaga, potentially. Then what? Kamala Harris?
Yeah, I mean, then the problem is significant, but less terrifying.
Right.
In that, I think people would agree that, you know, Kamala Harris has not shown herself to be a sort of inspiring.
Has she done anything?
Not ostensibly. And people seem to take against her. There may be a race element in that. I suspect there is.
A bit of race and misogyny through it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, she might not be the most inspiring person to take over midterm, but the great premise to your question, Matt, is that Trump has been defeated again.
Yes.
And that would mean he'd been defeated twice. And I think even the MAGA base, the absolute hardcore, although, of course, they'd say it'd been rigged again and all that, I think by 2026-7 or whatever you're talking about, I think by then the Republican movement would have moved on.
Well, he might well be in chokey by then.
He might well be in chokey.
Unpardoning himself unable to.
I think that the kind of arc that he's followed since his actual defeat in 2020 is it was rigged and I can win for you again in 2024. Yeah. If he doesn't, I do think that given this is being done according to the rules of showbiz, the Trump show gets axed.
Yeah.
So while in actual governmental terms, you're dead right that the incapacity of a president midterm would be a problem. You know, presidents have died midterm or, Nixon had to resign midterm. I mean, it's happened.
Yeah.
And I think, the system would be able to cope with that.
OK, before we go to a break, some president age questions for you. A little quiz. OK. So, the median age of US presidents, what would you take a shot at? Total.
60-something?
No, 55. Much really? Younger than I thought. The whole procession of those early guys, they were all 52,
I suppose
54,
they were,
55.
Yeah.
The youngest ever person to become president?
Kennedy.
No.
Obama.
No. Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh, 42. Really?
Yeah, but after McKinley was assassinated.
Okay. Okay.
So the youngest person to ever be elected as president was John Kennedy.
Was John Kennedy.
And he also holds the slightly grimmer record of being the youngest president at the end of his tenure, because he was only 46, having gone in at 43. Of course, he was assassinated. Theodore Roosevelt, the youngest ever former president, aged 50. And Ronald Reagan, as we said earlier, the oldest president at the end of his tenure, but will be superseded by Joe Biden, whatever happens in 2024.
Even if he stopped today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the longest retirement of any US president.
Oh, that's a good one. Carter?
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
He's been retired now.
He's in hospice care now.
He is. But he's 98 years old. He's also the oldest living president ever. And he has been retired for 42 years, which makes me feel absolutely ancient.
It's very funny. I interviewed him in Vienna at a UN Human Rights Congress in the 90s. And he was fantastic, charming,
Spades.
I mean, he has been the absolute example of what you should do if you've been head of government of a huge power, which is turn it to good.
Yes.
And he's spent that time, you know, public service on a global scale.
He seems to be a wholly good individual.
He's just a phenomenally
Isn't it a shame that that's not how he was received at the time? Really,
I think it was difficult because he was following the disaster of Watergate.
Yeah.
But at a time when America was still deeply paranoid about the Soviet Union, and Carter was seen as soft and not up to the job, and you know the Iranian embassy siege just decked him.
Yeah,
but he was a great statesman. He really was.
I'm trying to think any of our recent rash of leaders that could emerge as greater after power than they were before.
Oh, Gordon Brown.
Gordon Brown, yeah.
Gordon Brown is I think now a really significant global figure. I mean, during the pandemic, he was everywhere and all over. I mean, not physically, but he was. The good work he did on the very limited, sadly, vaccine sharing was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And his books about climate change and how to deal with crises and also just in person, he's at ease with himself now.
Yeah.
In a much, I think he is someone who will be very significant. And I think if Labour win, I hope they, you know, I know they talk to Blair a lot.
Yeah.
I hope they talk to Gordon as well.
I think that's right.
Because, you know, this is a guy who understands the global music, if you like. Yeah. He understands how the whole planet works.
Yeah.
And, you know, he did a great job, by the way, in getting us through the financial crash.
He absolutely did. And, of course, Liz Truss will be better after her power.
By definition.
But, I mean, she couldn't be any fucking worse, could
she? Yes, so. I mean, although we wait, and I'm sure we'll speak about this on the podcast when you know, with impatience, we finally get hold of her book.
The book,
you know.
What's it called?
It's called something like 10 years to Save the World. I mean, again, to speak of deranged, the deranged lettuce, it's amazing.
Right, anyway, very good. After the break, we are going to return with another all-powerful American. So it's been turned into a bit of a US-themed show,
it has.
Join us after the break, folks.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This week's episode is sponsored by The New European. We've got a special deal this week for new subscribers, where if you join, you can join for just £1 a week for all of our digital content. Or if you like to get the newspaper delivered to your house every Wednesday as a subscriber, you can have that for just another £1 a week. So that's £2 a week. And we'll give you a free signed copy of Rory Stewart's new book, Politics on the Edge.
It's a real bargain.
Which is worth £25, I think.
Yeah.
So, and it's signed by the man himself. So go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. And like I say, every new subscriber will get a copy of Rory Stewart's brand new hardback book signed by the author, Politics on the Edge. And now back to the show. So, Matt, another all-powerful America, maybe the most powerful American, if you believe some people.
It's true. So this week...
I say American. Of course, he's not even bloody American.
No, he's South African, but I mean, he spends most of his time in America. Elon Musk has had his biography by Walter Isaacson published this week. And why does this matter? Well, because having your biography written by Walter Isaacson is a bit like having a statue made of you. You know, it's a, you know, he's, and I think this is one of the reasons, by the way, that Musk agreed to be the subject of a Walter Isaacson biography. He had listed Isaacson's biography of Benjamin Franklin as one of his favorite books. And, you know, the other people that have been the subject of Walter Isaacson's biographies include Einstein, Leonardo, Steve Jobs, you know. And so clearly Elon Musk sees himself as a worthy member of that.
And by the way, the cover, pantheon, which I've only just seen just that second as you held it up, is absolutely striking how similar it is to the cover of the Steve Jobs one, where the Steve Jobs used that very famous pose where he had his index finger just touching his chin and his lip, and it's become a sort of iconic tech guru pose. Well, for people obviously just listening, you've got a very, very clear photo of Elon Musk staring straight down the camera, beautifully lit, beautifully made up, and his hands almost in prayer, just touching his chin like this. It's very kind of that iconic, you know, legendary image, like Kar Shivotta, you know, kind of portrait.
I'm a Roman emperor, basically.
Yes, it's
it
exactly
says.
Marcus Aurelius, yeah.
So it's stuffed full of details, much of which have been gone over in the press, have been gutting it like crazy. But one of the things that struck me as both comic but also a bit scary, we knew that Elon Musk loved Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
But that this biography makes clear that when we say love, I mean loved. So he talks about how he had a very unhappy childhood. His father, Errol, very brutal father, you know, bullying, demeaning the young Elon.
Yeah. Well, there was a great source of sense of it, him being bullied by gangs of kids in South Africa, but his dad being on the bully side.
The dad saying, you know, no son of mine, and so on. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, he tells Isaacson that The Hitchhiker's Guide, which for people who, you know, haven't encountered it, is a kind of comic science fiction. There are five books. It started as a radio series in the late 70s. The first book, I think, was published in 1979, and the last in the late 90s. And it's about a human being called Arthur Dent, an Englishman, very English Englishman, who gets rescued by his best friend Ford Prefect, who he doesn't know is from Beetlejuice 7, and is a reporter for the great guidebook, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And they get the Earth is destroyed to make way for an intergalactic bypass, and they go off on great adventures, which include trying to find out the answer to life, the universe, and everything, which is, as people may or may not know, 42. The problem is that no one knows what the question is. Now, so this, you know, Elon Musk, who emerges from the book as someone who is either in demon mode, as Grimes, the mother of some of his children, he has 11, puts it, or goofy mode. You know, and he quite often, after shouting at someone for half an hour, will show Isaacson or someone else a Monty Python sketch on his phone, which is very strange. Yeah. But he's really fixated by Douglas Adams's world.
Do you know, just to cut in briefly, I've only got one Douglas Adams story.
Oh, go for it.
Which was I used to be a tech reporter for the Daily Mirror when the internet was just starting. I had a column called Kelly's Eye, with the eye like the letter I. Douglas Adams must have been doing some tech game or something like this and was living in California at the time. And Microsoft or somebody said, we're launching this game. Do you want to come over and interview Douglas Adams? As you know, why he's doing it and all of this, talk about whatever. So I got on a plane, flew 11 hours to Los Angeles, checked into my hotel and got this was in May 2001, and got a text from the publicist saying, unfortunately, the interview's off. Douglas just died yesterday.
That is a good excuse, isn't
it? So I was nearly the last person to interview Douglas Adams, but not quite.
And you were the first not to.
I was the first person not to interview Douglas Adams.
It is a claim to fame, amongst your many claims to fame. It was one of those moments, wasn't it? Because he was only 49. There'd been no hint.
Was he only 49?
Yeah, good. I mean, he was extremely young, and reading the Isaacson book and picking up on this, I thought, what a shame it is that Adams isn't around to... Because what he did, I think, was... He's the Woodhouse of the tech era, I think, the P.G. Woodhouse of the tech era. And he turned into comic novels and comic plays. Maybe Matt Hill, our producer, has got a clip he can play from... There was, a stage adaptation of the book.
Oh, brilliant.
What the hell happened?
Well, I was just saying, there's this improbability drive switch here, you see, and I just pressed it.
Where are we, Trillium?
Well, exactly where we were, I think.
Then what happened to the missiles?
Well, according to this screen, they've just turned into a bowl of petunias and a very surprised-looking whale.
And an improbability factor of 8,767,128 to 1 against...
That's very good thinking, Earthman, you know that? You just saved our lives.
Oh, it was nothing really.
Was it? Oh, well, forget it then.
My favourite line from the whole thing was early on, where they were lamenting the destruction of Earth for this superhighway, and in the lamentation he said, of course, God had won a design award for his work on the Norwegian fjords.
It's really, really good. I mean, it's interesting how much it does suffuse the book. So Grimes says that one of the reasons that they call their baby, a second baby, Y, the full name is Andromeda Synthesis Story Musk, so probably Y is better, is that, as we know, Elon Musk, who changed Twitter's name to X, loves letters, Y, but he also loves the question, why? And Grimes is quoted as saying, Elon always says that we need to figure out what the question is before we can know the answers to the universe. And it's funny because initially you think, how charming, but then you think, actually, I wonder what Douglas Adams, were he alive today, would make of the fact that his books, which were written to enlighten and to amuse, have been turned into a kind of Bible by this multi-billionaire maniac. I mean, when he sent up one of his Tesla Roadsters in 2018 on the Falcon Heavy test flight. And in the glove compartment, he put a copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Did he really?
And he put a sign on the dashboard that read what appears on the cover of the book in the plays and in the series and the books. Don't panic.
Don't panic.
Now, on one level, that's charming. On another, it's slightly deranged.
Yeah.
And I think it's on many levels, it's a great shame that Douglas Adams isn't around to satirise the tech moguls, because he was the great guru of the personal computer age, you know, which happened on his watch, I guess. And he foresaw in The Guide both the Kindle, which didn't, I think, arrive until 2007, and the astonishing rise of audiobooks, because, of course, the book talks in his novel. So he would have been just so fantastic on these characters like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, who really step out of the pages.
They really do, don't they?
I think his loss was obviously just not a loss personally, but it was a loss to the culture because, you know, these people deserve to be satirised. Mm. And one of the things that comes out of the Isaacson book is the sense of almost demented seriousness about what he's doing.
Well, do you think we, you know, as a society, as a civilization now, take individuals like this far too seriously? Do we?
No, I wish it were so.
Well, maybe I phrased that badly. What I mean is, do you think that the way we think, our ambitions, our aspirations, our dreams, are they the dreams of individuals like Elon Musk? Have we allowed them to overtake more common dreams, perhaps?
I certainly agree with that. And I think that, you know, people like Zuckerberg and Elon Musk have become kind of techno Gatsbys, if you we aspire to. And their definition of public service is not public service. It's just huge accumulation of uncontrollable wealth.
But also mad dreams.
To
go to Mars, to colonise Mars.
Okay, you know. Another extraordinary detail in the book is that every week, Musk has a meeting that sometimes runs up to 2 hours called Mars Colonizer. And at this meeting, he and his a particular group, God knows of whom, on his staff, sit and talk about what the society they're going to build on the surface of Mars will be like. You know, will it be a democracy? What will the cities look like? How will we organise currency? What about the food? What will the robots do? You know, how will decision make? Now, you know, this is deranged, but also it tells you how he sees himself and the world in which he operates, which is that he's the person who's going to sort out interplanetary colonization. And to quote Monty Python, upon, you know, whom he apparently depends, you know, in the Holy Grail, when the peasant meets King Arthur and says, he says, "I'm the king." And the anarchist peasant says, "Well, I didn't vote for you." Right. Well, you know, none of us voted for Elon Musk. And yet, you know, it's been the source of considerable controversy in the last few days. Is one of the things in the book is the extent to which he deprived or didn't deprive the Ukrainian army of internet access while it was trying to attack in the, you know, Eastern Russian forces. And Musk said he didn't want total war to break out. Well, I think that would come as some news to the Ukrainians.
But bizarrely, In the telling of that, I found, because the story broke that Musk had switched it off, and then the story became
that wasn't what had happened.
No, I'd never switched it on.
Because
he didn't want to enable the Ukrainians to sink the Russian fleet, basically. Yeah. And strangely, I kind of followed his logic on that in that moment. If he had switched it off to favour or to prevent the Ukrainian assault on the Russian, that would have been a wholly different story, I think. But to go back to the earlier point, I do wonder, has there ever been a time in civilization where individuals have so kind of warped the whole ambition of humanity, you know, and why
that's the point.
Why isn't he having a 2-hour meeting about, you know, eradicating child poverty, or having a 2-hour meeting every week about making sure that there's clean water for everybody in Africa? You know, things that would make a tangible, you know, he talks about, you know, interplanetary colonization. We can't make this bloody planet work. Never, you know, let's just make this one work before we move on to
Mars. So much of it is to do with whim, isn't it?
Yeah.
So for whatever reason, Bill Gates, Microsoft founder, has concentrated on climate crisis, health in the developing world, and so on. He and his ex-wife Melinda Gates, their foundation, has done a lot of work. But that was just their choice, right? Zuckerberg, Bezos, Musk, they really do what they want. And when I say that, I don't mean in the way that the very wealthy have always done what they want. Not in the F. Scott Fitzgerald sense of, you know, the very rich are different.
Yes,
they've always been different.
Yeah,
I'm talking here about unrestrained power, and I don't think national democracies or global institutions have yet come to terms with how much we depend on these guys. I mean, we talked on a previous episode about a Ronan Farrow piece on Musk in The New Yorker, which listed the number of American departments that depend upon Elon Musk's goodwill.
Yeah.
Which is terrifying.
And we've touched on it in the past about the enormous influence that a company like Google has enjoyed.
Yes. You know,
because they, two guys, created something very clever that instantly, exponentially grew as a business and was borderless. And there was nothing a nation could really do to prevent its grip on advertising revenues, on search results, on the way, you know, literally helping control how people think and the stuff they find, all under the guise of ultimate altruism. You know, their, do you remember their first initial catchphrase was "Do no evil."
Do no evil, yeah, you know, absolutely.
But you can make a good case that Google has perpetrated more evil than many other multinational corporations through the way that they have controlled thought and sought to control news agendas and also their compliance with China as well,
yes.
Which they're but almost uncontrollable.
It's corruption. It's corruption 10x.
Yes,
because corruption on that scale, is more than any or almost any head of government can do.
And the thing that struck me, Matt, so just the point about Google, because I've met their top brass, and they've got some super smart people and people with really good intention, but they all buy into it. You know, they all believe they are doing the right thing, and there's nobody there to say, wait a minute. Can you see what's happening? Slow down. Stop this. You know, look at the effect of what you're doing over here.
And I think it's interesting that how this then leads on to AI, because understandably, the kind of way we're seeing AI at the moment is through the prism of Terminator, if you like. You know, we're terrified that AI is going to get conscious and it's going to turn into death robots and kill us all, right? Which is not a ludicrous thing to worry about, given the exponential speed at which AI is improving. But I'm afraid I'm a bit more cynical about it, which is, hold on a second, who is actually controlling the AI? It's all the same people. You know, Musk has his own AI company, so does Zuckerberg and so on. They are scraping the internet for data that can inform, you know, ChatGPT has kind of blown up because people are using it and going, this is incredible. This is going to be, again, unless we're very careful, yet another and much more powerful form of technology in the hands of a tiny group of people.
Yeah.
And no one is, you know, we're talking about AI regulation in terms of what AI can do, and that's good. But what we're not talking enough about is who in the end, because someone always does, is owning this. Who's getting the money from it? Who's exercising the power? Where, you know, who whom, as Lenin said. Mm. And I don't think there's anything like enough of that in the new. There's a, you know, it's a very, in some ways, very exciting debate being had about AI at the moment. But I'm afraid I always want to know, you know, who's the person putting the code in, and who's the person who's will be inevitably raking, you know, one of these guys is going to be the first trillionaire on the back of AI. And that takes you to a level of wealth that takes you way ahead of almost all the nation states in the world, and no one is doing a thing really to stop it.
And it's the thing that always terrifies me is it's always the unforeseen consequences of these things. You know, we're sitting here talking about AI and what will it mean, and there are some kind of obviously terrifying potential, but there are also some good things. Maybe AI could cure cancer, you know, or could solve malaria, whatever it might be. So there's all that. But just as, for instance, just to pick a topic close to my heart, the internet and the rise of these huge, huge multinational corporations that could serve people information, you know, in a way that they'd never received before, that was the death, really, or the beginning of the death of the local news industry in the UK. And when local news, for instance, suffers and dies and becomes a diminished operation, there's consequences to that as well. Councils start behaving badly. Life starts falling apart when you're on the fringes of society because you haven't got anybody, the fourth estate there on a local level, shouting for your cause, you know, or being interested about misdemeanors from people who should be behaving better. So there are these consequences that echo out like the circles in a when you drop a stone in a pond.
and it's unforeseeable. And there will be consequences to AI that we can't even imagine. Some will be amazing, I hope, but some will also be pretty catastrophic. How do you, you know, we need to put in some form of regulation before it starts tearing
and
the house.
And I think that the people like Zuckerberg and Musk, who've been very clever at saying, please regulate us, because they know that most governments, most legislators in the world don't have the expertise to regulate them effectively. You know, and they're asking for quick regulation, which is very smart. You know, regulators, please, you know. Because what you actually need is, I mean, I'd say royal commissions, that's silly, but you need detailed, high intensity, you know, very careful examination of what the real problems are, rather than just a few rules saying, let's make sure AI doesn't encourage terrorism, child porn and things like that. All of which is, necessary.
A national or, you know, multinational, in the case of the European Union, strategy around AI.
It has to be international.
No, I was listening, just totally different topic, but it came home to me the difference between, you know, the UK and, say, a nation like China. When you're talking about the influx of Chinese electric vehicles now, and the guy on the Radio 4 Today program was saying, what you've got to understand is that the Chinese have had this as a deliberate strategy for 20 years now. Yeah. They've hoovered up all the rare earth minerals they need. They've developed the science. They've got all the factories. They've been building the batteries for 20 years. And now you've got these battery companies who are now building cars. And they're about to become the single biggest exporter of cars on the planet. And that's happened in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
But he said, in comparison, the UK, everything's a tactical response. Oh, somebody's going to move their factory to France. Well, we'll give them 600 million quid to keep them there, and we'll invest in electric batteries in wherever it may be. But there's no strategy. It's all about tactics and very knee-jerk responses.
What is Sunak doing on AI? He's having a summit, right?
Oh, come on.
Now,
going to a bloody conference. What a waste of time.
Have a conference. You know,
what a waste of time.
What you need is a strategy. Yeah. Although, you know, the strategy he has at the moment is to, one hopes, lose the next election, which is, you have
to
give.
He's playing that one well.
He's playing a blinder.
Right.
So what did we not talk about?
What didn't we talk about?
Well, one thing I'd like to squeeze in a mention of, which is, as you know, I need hardly mention, and anyone who's watching on YouTube will be well aware, I see myself as a bit of a fashion maven. Thank you. And yourself.
Very Steve Jobs today with your black t-shirt.
I know. I've made the...
Before he got ill,
I've made the big, you know, never mind the little black dress. I've made the big black t-shirt, you know, a thing that the must wear. But I went to the preview of the Victoria and Albert Museum's mega exhibition on Gabrielle Chanel. And it's, joking aside, it's not a subject, couture is not a subject I know very much about or have a deep knowledge of, but it is stunning.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's that they've managed to curate it brilliantly. It is fantastically organized for the layperson as well as the expert, and it's just visually mesmerizing.
Right.
And what it made me think, actually, apart from, you know, what a terrific exhibition it was, and it's definitely one to make an effort to go and see. I know it's booked up for quite a while, but do go. Is what a great era we are going through for museums. So parking for a moment all the eBay scandal at the British Museum, you know, you've got Tristram Hunt at the V&A knocking out the park. You've got Ian Blatchford at the Science Museum knocking out the park. You've got Nicholas Cullinan at the National Portrait Gallery doing so. And I just hope that, I have no hopes of this government because I don't think they care about culture, but I really hope that the next government understands how important this is to Britain, and not just in terms of its tourist value, although that's important, and its soft power, although that's important, but just to its the kind of the nature of being British. And by the way, there are museums and galleries outside of London which are fantastic.
Amazing stuff. Yeah.
So it really brought that home to me.
And also, I think something that we can be genuinely proud of.
Absolutely,
it's all free.
It is, you know, it is incredible how much you can get for nothing.
To go into, I mean, obviously they have these
special things
that you have to pay for. But you can go into the Science Museum and you could spend all day
absolutely
ogling the most amazing things. And it's cost you nothing.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
So anyway, do go see the Chanel exhibition, even if you don't care about couture. It's amazing.
Brilliant. And one thing that I thought we could touch on is these dogs from America, these Bully XLs or XL Bullies. Which is it, by the way?
I think XL.
Is it XL Bully?
It sounds like, again, like a sort of... a robot or a laptop.
I mean, they look
an aggressive laptop.
I mean, they just. I mean, these things. When you see them, there's one on the street near where I live, and it looks absolutely terrifying. You know, I would cross the street. But the question about, you know, there seems to be an argument, which is, you know, it's the people, not the dogs. And I said, well, fine, okay, but if why take the chance? You know, if there are bad people out there, don't let them have a dog that can rip people to pieces in 60 seconds.
I feel very sorry for these creatures because they've been bred by bad actors for bad purposes.
Yeah, well, who the hell would want to own one of these things unless it was macho thing?
But you've just answered the question. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, that question is the same as who the hell watches Andrew Tate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is who would want to watch? Who would want to own a dog that clearly is genetically programmed to attack?
Yeah.
And the answer is the kind of idiot that sits watching Andrew Tate YouTubes and imbibes that kind of phony machismo. And I think it's a great shame. But I'm afraid I agree with you that we can't have dogs like that.
No.
Prowling around neighborhoods. You know, it just isn't acceptable, and it's a very sad thing to observe.
Well, it is, because I think, you know, probably for some of the wrong reasons, in that she sees it as a kind of popular Daily Mail kind of campaigning point. Suella Braverman will ban them, and a lot of these dogs will get euthanized, and that's very sad. But honestly, I'd rather have 100 of these dogs euthanized than one kid being ripped to shreds by one of them. So
it's
fine.
A question of priorities. I mean, you know, I'm a massive animal lover, cats and dogs, but I don't want killer dogs roaming the streets. I bitterly hate the people that breed them and the people that buy them. And I hope they're ashamed of themselves, afraid.
Good for you. Well, we'll end on a note of absolute agreement. As usual, actually.
Always. Occasional domestic, but you know.
Occasional.
Always.
We move on quickly.
Never let the sun go down on an argument on the two mats.
Those nights we phone each other late at night to kiss and make up over fallings out.
Miss you.
Remember, folks.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Send us your questions and we will answer them definitively. We will be rolling out a second weekly question and answer episode later this month. So the address for all your questions is 2Matts, that's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.co.uk. 2Matts at tnepublishing.co.uk. And our special deal, remember, subscribe and get a free copy of Rory Stewart's wonderful new book, Politics on the Edge. Just head to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. And there's a link in the show notes. Thank you, as ever, to the third Matt, our producer, Matt Hill, at Rethink Audio. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.